somewhat of a fateful parsha. History takes a turn here. And in fact, Chazal tell us that the word Vayeshev, actually, which sounds somewhat innocent, somewhat neutral, doesn't sound so eventful, actually even sounds kind of passive. But Chazal tell us that the connotation of Vayeshev is actually negative. That Vayeshev is a language of tsar. And this is related, as the Torah Tumima connects it. That part is from the Gemara, Masech Sanhedrin, and Daf Kuvav. But the Torah Tumima connects it to the phrase in the Medrash, which Rashi quotes, of Bikesh Yaakov Leshev Beshalva, that Yaakov thought he could get a break. And Yaakov, of course, has had a very tumultuous life, and it's not really about to get any easier. And here Yaakov thought, okay, maybe I can finally sit Beshalva, I can sit peacefully. Kofetz Olav Rigzo Shel Yosef, and all those stresses and all the tensions of Yosef jump on him. And Rashi tells us that this is Ki'ilu to make the point that tzaddikim should understand and should appreciate that it's not enough for them that they have shalva in the next world. What are they looking for in this world? So it's a difficult point to understand. We're generally pro shalom and peace. What's wrong with seeking out shalva? And this whole idea that Vayeshev has a negative connotation to it when it seems so neutral. The Torah Tumima seems to understand it as, you know, a little bit of dramatic foreshadowing. You know, you see somebody's plans being thwarted. It's kilo, like when someone says, oh, what could possibly go wrong? And then the next scene you see something going wrong. And just when you think somebody is going to be able to relax and be able to sit quietly, that's kind of setting up the stage, you know, for things to go in the opposite direction. So it's almost with a dramatic irony, you know, that if it's being declared that somebody was settled, that it must mean that they're about to be unsettled. But the idea of Bikesh Leshev B'Shalva, what's wrong with that? Perhaps we could suggest that the Shalva that's referred to here ties into some of the other criticisms that we find surrounding this whole episode. For example, Chazal are critical of Yaakov for showing apparent favoritism to one of his sons, to Yosef, and suggest that that is the cause of the galus, that the exile happens because Yaakov favors one son and gives him the gift and singles him out. And perhaps the idea is that when we contrast Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, as Chazal do here, the Olam Haba is the Olam Ha'emes. So you can treat people who are special in a special way, and you don't have to worry that other people will get jealous, or people will complain, or that there's any kind of emotional component that's going to interfere. But in this world, that's not how it works. In this world, you have to be concerned that people will interpret your actions, and people will get offended, and people will get jealous, and that is a necessary component of understanding how to operate. So to be b'shalva, to think you can just sit back, so to speak, in this sense, and not worry about the reaction to how you interact with people in ways like this is a mistake. And that's perhaps what we get, for example, the Gemaras that talk about the Churban, the Gemaras in Gittin, which open up with the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, and tell us that that was the beginning of that Golos, very much a parallel here, that Golos begins with an episode of jealousy and of one person being invited to a party and someone else not being invited to a party. And before that story begins, so the Gemara quotes the pasuk Ashrei Adam Mefache Tamid. It's fortunate for a person. A person is fortunate if he's always afraid. And Tosfos asks, what does that mean? You're not supposed to always be afraid. It means you don't have a muna. And Tosfos has an approach there. But perhaps what's going on, it's similar to here, is that you have to be concerned that in this world you have to worry about how people are going to react to things like that. Not being invited when the other one is invited, to one son getting a gift when the other sons don't. You have to recognize that that's going to have consequences in this world. And you can't sit back and say, well, I've got a good reason, and this one deserves it, that one doesn't deserve it. It's not going to fly. It's not going to be able to end well. And that's one of the major lessons of that Golus, of this Golus. And perhaps that's a part of the imagery here. It's also noted by many of the Mefarshim that there is a direct contrast to the very end of the previous parsha. The end of the previous parsha talks about the settling of Esav and his family. And now we contrast the beginning of this parsha with that of Yaakov, and he settles Beretz Megurei Aviv. So he is contrasted with different life choices. He is settling in the land of his father, and the Mefarshim have different understandings of why that's emphasized, because he was inheriting the land, or because he considered it a covenant to live where his ancestors were buried, or maybe because the ancestors had a good reputation and that was a benefit to him, or because he wanted to learn from their actions, and that was itself an act of covet. There are other interpretations also of what a Megurei Aviv means. Does it mean the place that his father settled, or some suggest that it means a place where his father was a stranger, and here also he was a little bit of an outsider, or maybe the idea that it connotes a certain like language of fear. That's how some of the Mefarshim understand. And just like Yitzchak, he has family tensions, and that's what the pasuk is conveying. The next pasuk tells us, Ela told us Yaakov, Yosef, and Shvas Reishana, Hayroes Achiv Esachav Batzon. So here, really the pasuk is Ela told us Yaakov, Yosef. Ela tells Yaakov, Yosef, and Shvas is two different parts of the sentence. But one of the great Sefer Chassidus, Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy, so the Sefer told us Yaakov Yosef brings the two together. But there's also some connotation of that in the pasuk also, that the toldos of Yaakov are very much connected to Yosef. And we found the word toldos a number of times already in Sefer Bereishis, a number of times in First Aliyos, so we've talked about it a few times this year. And we've seen that toldos can mean the descendants, and toldos can mean these are the life stories. And maybe in both cases, it makes sense to start off focusing on Yosef, even though Yosef was not chronologically the oldest, but he was essentially the leader. And if we're talking about the story of Yaakov's family, so then certainly to launch right into the story of Yosef, we can understand that. The Rashbam understands essentially a combination of both meanings, that when we say Ela told us Yaakov, we don't just mean his sons, we mean all of the Shivim Nefesh that we're going to read about at the end. So essentially, this is all one long sentence from now till the end of Sefer Bereishis. We're explaining how the 70 descendants of Yaakov end up in Mitzrayim. So we have to give you the whole context of how that happens. So everything from now until the end of Vayechi is all basically being introduced with these words. Okay, so in any event, we're told that Yosef is 17 years old. So why do we need to know that he's 17 years old? So here you find Mefarshim taking opposite opinions. That it could be that it's related to what the next pasuk tells us, or the rest of the same pasuk tells us, either to tell us opposite points, either to tell us that he was immature and we should forgive him for because he was only 17, and that could explain some of the things that we'll read about in the rest of this pasuk, or maybe to impress us that he was mature. Some have shown him say that way, that we see that he's given a leadership role in terms of managing the flock. Maybe that's the point, that we're being told that he was mature for a 17-year-old. Others suggest it so that we can keep track of what eventually happens here, and that we can recognize that he's absent from his family for 22 years, if you do the math. So to know that he's 17 now is significant for that purpose. But, okay, so we're told that he's 17. And then we're told something very surprising. So you have Yosef es dibasam ra el avihem. So Yosef brings the bad reports to his father. So this is surprising because this would seem to be a prohibition in the Torah, a prohibition of Lashon Hara. So we know that that's normally something we frown upon. So how exactly to relate to this is a very important point, that first of all, it's a discussion in the Mefarshim whether this was something negative or something justifiable. So many of the Mefarshim do see this as negative. We mentioned a moment ago that maybe it should be seen in the context of the fact that he was young and immature, and only because he was 17 he did this, but essentially this was Lashon Hara, and certainly some of the Mefarshim do see it that way, and the Chafetz Chaim, the Shmira Salashin, was critical of Yosef because of this. But there are others who assume that if Yosef was doing this, it must have been justified, because after all, what was Yosef's last name? Hatzadik, right? So therefore, if Yosef was a tzadik, so then presumably it must have been justified. So this becomes a crucial issue, la halacha l'maisa. And the halacha l'maisa in one of the most significant and tricky and consequential areas of life. Because when it comes to Lashon Hara, so we spend necessarily a lot of time studying the concepts and the rules of Lashon Hara. And a lot of it boils down to one big judgment call. It's an informed judgment call. We have to spend a lot of time developing the knowledge and the sensitivity to make a good judgment call. But it's a judgment call, essentially, to understand what we are prohibited to say and what we're obligated to say. Because even though we're not supposed to say things that are prohibited, that are negative, we're not supposed to say things that are disparaging about other people, but we are obligated to say things that are necessary to protect people from harm. It's what we call l'toelas. So to know the difference between the two is crucial, and it's not at all easy. It's a matter of great judgment in order to be able to make the right decision. So we spend a lifetime trying to develop the sensitivity so that we'll make the right decision. So how exactly we relate to that question and that decision probably first requires us to understand what's the whole logic behind Lashon Hara L'Toelas, the idea that you can look at this different ways depending on the circumstance. So here, you have to first consider, what is the Yisur of Lashon Hara about? So the Yisur Lashon Hara could be understood as an Yisur of Midos, that you shouldn't be a gossip, you shouldn't be somebody who likes indulging in all the dirt. Or it could be understood more as an action, that by speaking negatively about somebody, you are putting them at risk of bad consequences and putting them at risk of getting harmed in an unwarranted way. So those two understandings affect how toelis works. Because if it's about being a gossip, if we want to translate Lashon Hara essentially as gossip, so then one could say that if something is purposeful, if you're trying to save people from harm or bring other benefit, so then it's simply not Lashon Hara. It's outside the definition of Lashon Hara. But if you understand Lashon Hara is not just gossip, but that which puts somebody else at risk, so then even purposeful Lashon Hara technically is Lashon Hara. So let's say, for example, some of the classic instances of Lashon Hara L'Toelas. If somebody's about to enter into a business deal with somebody who's dishonest, if somebody's about to get married to somebody who's dangerous, so these are classic examples of where you're obligated to warn the person. So the person you're talking about, are they going to get hurt by what you're saying? For sure. They're going to lose out on a shidduch, they'll lose out on a business deal, for sure they're going to get hurt. So why is it justified then? It's justified presumably because you have a competing value. What's the competing value? The Torah also mandates, Lo samod al dam reacha. We're not allowed to stand by when somebody is at risk of being hurt. So therefore, we have two competing mandates here. On the one hand, we're not supposed to disparage people, which the Torah prohibits in Parshas Kedoshim, Lo Selech Rachel B'Amecha. And on the other hand, we're not allowed to stand by when somebody is at risk of harm. And as the Rambam explains in Sefer HaMitzvot, it doesn't just mean risk of death, it means any degree of spiritual or material or physical harm. So you have to prevent that. So the two are in conflict with each other, and one is going to do battle with the other. And the idea that these two are balanced against each other, the idea that they are held up against each other can perhaps be illustrated by the fact that they are two halves of the same pasuk. The same pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim tells us both. So that gives us two different understandings. Is it Lashon Hara is a midah, and if you're speaking purposefully, it's simply not the midah of gossip of Lashon Hara? Or is Lashon Hara about putting somebody at risk, and when you're speaking with Tuelis, you are doing that, but it's justified and necessitated by Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha. So what's the difference between the two? There are a lot of differences between the two. But one of the major differences is what kind of a process do you have to go through in order to figure out if you are speaking properly or not. Because there's really no safe side here. If you say something you shouldn't say, it could be an Avera of Lashon Hara. If you fail to say something that you need to say, it's an Avera of Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha. You have to be very careful here. So what kind of a process do you have to go through in order to make sure you're doing the right thing? So if you see Lashon Hara as the Midah, and any time it's purposeful, it's not Lashon Hara. So then you have a pretty straightforward process that essentially to be intending L'Toelis is enough. And that's what's quoted in the name of the Chazon Ish. As long as you intend L'Toelis, that's sufficient. But if you believe that there actually is an Issur Lashon Hara, it's just outweighed by the imperative of Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha, so then that becomes more of a process. You have to really think about things carefully to make sure that it is justified to outweigh the Isser. So the Chafetz Chaim in his Sefer, in two places he has it differently. There is 5 or 7 criteria that you have to go through in order to make sure that it's justified. And others have different lists. And they have 3 rules, different ways of counting up what you have to prioritize. And among them was the Afikayam. The Afikayam was a contemporary and associate of Reb Chaim Brisker, his name is Reb Yechiel Rabinowitz. And in his Sefer, the beginning of the second chelik of the Afikayam, he has a little Dvar Torah about the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, about our psukim here. And he says that Yosef presumably was speaking justified Lashon Hara. And if we look carefully at the psukim, you can learn 3 rules for when Lashon Hara is justified. If you want to know what is the process to figure out when Lashon Hara is appropriately L'Toelis, look at the story that's told here about Yosef. So what are the 3 rules? So first of all, just to clarify, what kind of Toelis would this be? So normally the Toelis, if you talk about Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha, so normally you're talking to a victim to save them from a predator. Don't go into business with this person. Don't marry this person. This is a slightly different kind. This is about talking to an authority figure. The assumption was here that the brothers were engaged in some kind of misbehavior. And in order to set them straight, you had to go to the authority figure, to the father, and tell him what was happening. So it's a different kind of Toelis, but that's also recognized as Toelis. There are some of the Rishonim that suggest maybe it was more the classic kind, that maybe the brothers were being neglectful in terms of their responsibility towards the flock. So they were causing losses to the father, so it was more about protecting a victim. But more likely it's brought down that the brothers were engaged in other kinds of behavior that was problematic, or seemed to be. It's a discussion we'll come to in a second. And therefore, Yosef was coming to Yaakov as an authority figure. So you could ask, why didn't he just speak to them? Why didn't he just tell them to stop? Why did he have to go tell on them? So says the Afikayam, we have the answer. The answer tells us, the Pasuk says, V'hunar espenei v'ilav espenei zolfa. They considered him a brat. They didn't take him seriously. So he's not going to be able to convince them to change their behavior. So he says that's rule number one. Rule number one is that there's no other way to address the problem. That there's nothing else you can do besides go to a third party to take care of it. So then that's what you need to do, but you should only do this if there's no other way to take care of it. What's rule number two? So there's also something interesting in the way the pasuk is phrased here. It says, "Ve'yavei Yosef es dibasam ra el avihem." So why does it say "Ve'yavei"? There's so many words in Hebrew for speech. Why "Ve'yavei" literally would mean he carried. So why is the language "Ve'yavei" used? So he suggests that the imagery of "Ve'yavei" is like you're carrying an object. It's meant to connote that when you pick up an object and you put it down, it's the same thing when you pick it up and you put it down. It doesn't change at all. So too, Yosef would deliver these reports. There is no spin. There's no editorializing. It's the same thing when you pick it up and when you put it down. Nothing changed in between. And that's very crucial also. It should be objective. It should be just the facts. There shouldn't be anything put into it. It's evocative of the comment of the Ur Zarua. The Ur Zarua says that the reason Hotzah on Shabbos is considered a difficult malacha to relate to, because all the other malachos are creative in ways that we can appreciate, and Hotzah doesn't seem like anything changes. It says, Mikara chefetz v'hashta chefetz. You pick it up, you put it down, it's the same thing. So too, here the imagery is that nothing changes, and that's also crucial. If you're going to say something, say it's the Toelas, it has to be completely factual without anything added in. It's also interesting to note that among the Rishonim, we find the Ramban in a few places. He distinguishes between Hotzas Diba and Havas Diba. That to be Motzi Diba, he says, that is Sheker. And to be Mevi Diba is to tell the truth. Diba, he's assuming, is always negative. There's some Rishonim who see Diba as more neutral. Because here it says Diba Sam Ra. So it's not clear if it's Diba neutral and only Diba Ra is bad. But Ramban and others, Tar Tamima has a discussion about this also, that he understands the language of Havas Diba to mean factual reporting, and Hotzas Diba means like you're creating something. And so we say Motzi Shemra in the contemporary terminology. We say Motzi Shemra is a false allegation. So that language, that's how the Ramban understands is the distinction between the two. So here what the Afikayam says is maybe Diba, it's meant to connote that it's completely factual without anything added in. So that's rule number two. Rule number three is actually the most controversial of them. It parallels one of the more controversial rules in the Chafetz Chaim. So he brought these reports El Avihem. So why does it say Avihem? Isn't that a strange phrasing? If you get into a fight with your brother, do you say to him, I'm going to tell your father on you? And you'll say something like, I'll tell daddy on you. Because you have the same father. You don't say, I'm going to tell your father on you. So how come here it doesn't say El Aviv? Wasn't Yaakov also his father? Why does it say their father? So the Afikayam notes here that it's to emphasize that when he gave his reports, he was not thinking at all about the fact that Yaakov was his own father and that he would score some points as the favorite son by looking better in comparison. All he was thinking about was that Yaakov was the father of these boys and he is the one who could change their behavior. But any ulterior benefit was not on his mind at all, and that's rule number three. That there shouldn't be any side motive, you should be pure of heart here. And that parallels one of the rules of the Chafetz Chaim, the most controversial rules, where he says that if you're going to speak about somebody with Toelas, you can't have any other grievance or any other animus against this person, which will complicate things and give you an ulterior motive. And there were many who were very opposed to this idea. They said that that's comparable to saying that if you're sick on Yom Kippur and you have to eat, that you shouldn't be allowed to eat if you also like the food, because that's an ulterior motive, and that you can't do. So if you need to survive, then you need to eat whatever other motives you have. So too here, if somebody is a threat to another person, you have to protect them even if you have an ulterior motive. How could you say that you can't do it? So, you know, presumably the Chafetz Chaim understood that, and that's what you also find from other comments of the Chafetz Chaim. But what the Chafetz Chaim seems to be highlighting is that this corrupts the process, that when you have a grievance against the person, it becomes very difficult to have an honest evaluation of whether it's necessary to do this or not. And this was a very controversial point. There's a whole sefer you can find in the library. I return it. Called the Tochas Chaim, which is all about, the whole sefer is defending the Chafetz Chaim on this point. On this one issue, the whole sefer is about this, about whether Lashon Hara L'Toelas has to be without any kind of ulterior motive or not. It's a lot to discuss about it. And it's, as you understand, a controversial and tricky point. And there's a Haskama in that sefer from Rishrai Dabliski, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who passed away, I believe, in the past year. He's a great tzaddik and Talmud Chacham, and who was particularly known for being very careful in Lashon Hara. And one of the points he makes there is addressing this tension between having a very rigorous process of figuring out if you're allowed to say something and recognizing that innocent people might be at risk if you're not going to say something. So the way he seems to understand it is that you basically have a good faith requirement to do your best to satisfy all these criteria. Then if you can't perfectly satisfy all these criteria, but somebody's still at risk, you may have to take action nonetheless. But your lechatchila requirements is to do the best you can to try to make sure that all of this is addressed. So in any event, so this is a major discussion, this concept of Lashon Hara L'Toelas, and is that what's going on here? And if so, what can we learn from it? But many assume that there was something wrong here, and that this played a role also in Yosef's tzaras afterwards. And there's some suggestion, which Rashi brings part of and others discuss, that Yosef was accusing the brothers of improper behavior with women, and I guess a little bit of synergy here of eating Eiver Menachai, of eating animals without Shechita. And really it wasn't true, because it wasn't what it looked like. So for example, these animals were not real animals. They were Sefer Yetzirah animals. They were created through Kabbalistic means. So there's a lot to discuss about that. If it ever comes up, you should make sure to look into the sugya. If you create animals through Sefer Yetzirah, and whether they're obligated in Shechita or not, the Shla here in Parshas Vayeshev talks about that. But this is something which is increasingly relevant, the different ways of creating meat which don't necessarily go through the normal processes, and what exactly is the status of that. It actually draws upon this literature, just like you also find discussions of whether somebody who's created a person through Sefer Yetzirah, whether they count for a minyan or not, and for other halachic purposes. There's quite a literature about that. The Ragachover has a tshuva about that, and before him the Chacham Tzvi, and Rebak of Emden, father and son, Shuvas, they both talk about this, and many others talk about the whole literature about that question. So some of it cites this parsha and this discussion of what was really going on with the brothers. So it's all quite fascinating. And perhaps... Sorry. So perhaps part of the message here is that, you know, sometimes we don't know how far to go when it's bidam l'chav schuz. And sometimes it's not kedai to go too far being dam l'chav schuz, because you put yourself at risk and because you could make bad decisions in the other direction. But it's worth reminding ourselves sometimes that there are sometimes very extreme possibilities that we don't even think of that might actually put things in a different light. And that's also worth factoring in when it's possible to do so. There are those who read this pasuk differently. It doesn't fit as well with the words, but that maybe it wasn't about Yosef bringing reports to the father, but he was talking to the brothers and saying that Estibasam Roa El Avihem, he was telling them how their misbehavior was reflecting badly on the father, that it was the Diba Roa that was coming to him because of what they were doing, and therefore he was sending that message. Okay, in any event, so just to look a little further. So the next pasuk tells us, Yisrael ahavis Yosef mikol banav, kiven zekunim hulo, v'asalo ksonos pasim. So this making of the ksonos pasim, which like the Gemara tells us, got him in trouble. But the Netziv highlights that everything before that in the pasuk is trying to give us a certain context here, that at least we should appreciate that it came from a spiritual place. So first of all, the pasuk uses the word Yisrael instead of Yaakov, his new name. So in telling us that that was what was driving him, the spirituality that he appreciated in Yosef, Mikol Banav, and it says he appreciated him more of than all of his sons, rather than saying Mikol Achav, appreciating him more than his brothers, in order to emphasize that he was the one who was most like him, he was the one who was most in his spiritual image. And that was because Kiven Zekunim Hulo, he was a son of his old age, he was Mishamish him more than the other sons, and he had more of an opportunity to become like him. So all of that contributed to why he had this favorite image in his father's mind. So he made him a Ksonas Pasim. So what is a Ksonas Pasim? What does that mean in English? So it's Technicolor. This is famously translated as Technicolor. But most of the Rishonim don't see it that way. The Radak says that it means many colors, but it's not clear that that's what it means. Rashi, understanding from the Gemara, is it means silk. And Rashi also uses the word karpas here, which is very interesting. Pesach. Right, so the ref to Pesach might actually be significant. Rabbi J.J. Schachter has spoken on this, and he makes the point that maybe he has sources to back this up, that the karpas at the Seder plate is meant to invoke this karpas, and it's meant to remind us of how we got into Gullus in the first place. I think he published this maybe in a few places, but I think in the Wayu Haggadah you can find this written up, that the karpas, the Seder plate, is meant to remind us of this karpas, of this coat, which began us in the process of Gullus, got us in such trouble. And that's a part of what the Haggadah requires us to remember. So some understand that it's silk. The Ben Ezra points to a pasuk in Daniel that maybe suggests it was a long coat, or many colors, or silk. Whatever it was a fancy coat. Okay, so the next pasuk tells us, "V'yu echav ki oso ahav avihem mikol echav v'yusnu oso v'lo yochlu dabru l'shalom." So they saw that he was favored, and they couldn't be at peace with him, and they couldn't talk to him peacefully. And in the Tziv comments, and Maral Diskin has a similar comment, they assumed it was mutual. They hated him, and they assumed that he hated them, because they thought this was all phony. That even if he came and said shalom to them, they didn't take it to be sincere. And this ties into the previous pasuk, that let's say he was reporting on them and he had sincere motives, but they assumed that they were innocent of anything and he was just reporting on them in order to look good. So then they thought he was being two-faced, that he would talk about them behind their back, and then when he was with them, he would be friendly. So they didn't take it sincerely, and they couldn't handle him. They had a very hard time with him. So Vayachalom, Yosef, Chalom, Vayage Vayachav, Vyasifu Odsno also. So here they had a dream, and he told the dream to the brothers. The Netziv says that was a mistake, because the Gemara says if you have a dream, you're not supposed to tell other people about the dream. And you see that it gets people upset here. You see that they hated him because of it, and they added on more hatred. Shlomo Fisher has in one of his drushes that we know that we have a tainus on Tisha B'Av and we have a tainus on Shavuos B'Tammuz, and those tainusim, they commemorate events connected to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, But we also have a tradition that they also parallel things in Chumash, things in earlier in our history. So Tisha B'Av was the Chet HaMeraglim, and Shavasot B'Tammuz was the Egel HaZov, etc. So what happened on Asar B'Teves in Chumash? So Rav Shlomo Fisher writes that he can't prove it 100%, but he thinks that the Mechiras Yosef took place on Asar B'Teves. So it's an important point hashgraphically, because it means that one of the themes we should be thinking about, Asar B'Teves is still a few weeks away, but it's close enough to this parsha, so that on Asar B'Teves we should be thinking about this particular Avera. The Meshech Chachma writes in one place that whenever we look for a paradigmatic Avera ben Adam l'makom, we look to the Egel Azav, and whenever we look for a paradigmatic Avera ben Adam l'chavero, we look to the Bechiras Yosef. And it's perhaps the prime example of not just an interpersonal Avera, but an interpersonal Avera based on bad cheshbonos, where you think that you're doing the right thing, you think you're defending yourself, you think you can justify what you're doing, and you end up bringing about disastrous consequences. And that's how so many interpersonal averos happen, and so many tragic results come about. So Asar B'Teves, you know, still a few weeks away, but it's a time to really ponder this whole parsha of Mechiras Yosef. And a little bit less seriously, forgive me, we could say there's a remez to that in this pasuk, that this still took place in Asar B'Teves, because here the pasuk says, "V'yasifu od snow," so you see it was in the winter, it was snowing. Okay, so just to add a little bit more, so, "V'yomer aleihem shimuna achalom hazeh shechalamti, listen to my dream, v'nei anachnu ma'almi malumi m'sech ha'sadeh, v'nei kam alumasi v'gam nitzavi, hinei..." So he gives this whole dream with the sheaves about how they bent down and how they all bowed down to him. There's an interesting halachic ha'ari here. There's a malacha called ma'amer. It's one of the malachas on Shabbos, a gathering. And it's a machlok saposkim, whether in order to violate that malacha it has to be bound together with your gathering. So Rav Nosson Gestetner, one of his farim, he points out that if you put together, Rashi here quotes Unklus, on this pasuk of ma'almim alamim, if you put together the way Unklus translates and the way Rashi brings in Ma'amrim into this Amorim, rather, Ketargumo Ma'asrim, Ma'asrim, tied up, Amorim. So Rashi and Unklus together interpreting this pasuk, it says, you see here that Ma'amir should mean to tied up in order to violate the Malach. Okay, but anyway, he just has this imagery that he's going to be in charge. So they're all shocked at that. It says, V'yomer lo achav ha'maloch t'mloch aleinu v'mashol t'mshol banu. So they were upset about that. And some point out this pasuk could be explained based on the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon tells us there's a difference between Melech and Moshe. And a Melech is a king who rules with the consent of the people, and a Moshe is somebody who rules against the consent of the people. So they were saying to him, Hamaloch Timloch Aleinu, you think you're going to be the king with our consent? That's not happening. So then the rest of it, so that's not true. So then the rest of it's not true either. So I don't think you're going to be able to rule over us without our consent either, because we've already shown you that it's already not true. But the problem is, the Gemara says that every dream, even if it is true, has parts that aren't true by its very nature. So you're not going to contradict it by saying it's partially untrue. And the Gemara actually proves that by showing the next pasuk, of V'yachalom Ol Chalom Acher, V'yisapro Solechav, V'yomer Hinei Chalamti Chalom Ol, V'hinei HaShemesh V'hayereach V'acharas Arko Chalim V'shtachavim Li. So here I have the sun and the moon, and 11 stars all bowing down to me. So the sun and the moon, that represents his parents, his father and his mother. His mother was no longer alive. So the Gemara says, here you see there is something that's not true. And that's the way it is. Every dream, even if it's true, there's something that's not true. Remember once Yoel Steinberg, his Rav Schechter's nephew, he once told me before, which I don't remember actually the answer to the question, but it was an interesting question. You never think about this. So you know, we all know the story from our youngest age. So we learn in elementary school about the story about the dream of Yosef and the sun and the moon bowing down to him. So how exactly does that work? Right? So the sun and the moon are circles. So what does it look like? If How do you imagine it even? So we're not supposed to draw the sun and the moon for because of Avodah Zarah issues, but how would you even picture a sun and the moon bowing down? What does it look like if a tennis ball would bow down? What would that look like? So I don't remember what the answer to the question is, but it's hard to even imagine what the imagery is. But okay. In any event, so this was a dream. You think this makes any sense? You think this is what's going to happen? So outwardly, he excoriates him and tells him not to talk like this. But inwardly, he's thinking something else, it seems. So the brothers, they're more upset. There's more kinah. And the Mefarshim talk about why before they hate him and now they're mekaneh him. Is there a difference? The first dream was sinah, now it was kinah. So, among the interpretations, Ibn Bachya says that the first, it was just that they were upset that the father loved him more, so they hated him because of that. But now they see that there's some mamashus, that he's going to become the king, so there's a kinah. As Ravram ben Aramam comments a little similarly, that one dream, they thought, okay, that's what he's thinking about during the day. So they hate him for thinking like that, but there's no kinah. But once it's repeated, they start to think that there's something real here. So they have kinah, and there are other interpretations as well. And Aliyah ends with Aviv Shamar Sadaber. So here there are multiple interpretations that are probably related. So it sounds literally that he was protecting the matter. He was trying to keep things under control. That here Yosef is provoking all this hatred and jealousy by talking about it. So the father in the previous pasuk is saying, stop talking, stop saying this, and getting people upset. But Rashi tells us there's a different meaning, that he did want this future to come about. So he was waiting and looking forward, in a sense, for this to happen, for Yosef to be in charge. The Rashbam writes that because he remembered this, so this is what was able to click later on, that when Yosef sends him the message that he's alive, and he sends him the wagons, and the wagons are meant to remind him of what they originally learned, so the reason that worked is because it then all made sense, that this prophecy that he would eventually be in charge, and he would eventually be in this position, so because Yaakov remembered that, so then that all came together, and that's what the pasuk is kind of foreshadowing here with that ends that aliyah, that okay, he stored this away in his mind. There's one more part of foreshadowing, which this whole aliyah is a little bit rife with, a lot of foreshadowing at the beginning and the end, and it's actually a theme throughout the parsha, that there is a lot of anticipating of what is yet to come. So you should anticipate a wonderful Shabbos, and God willing, we look forward to some chazara on Sunday. And again, anybody who has any